Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the debate over immigration continues to rage today, especially in presidential political posturing, my guest today says a look at our past history of Asian American immigration would be instructive in better understanding our current immigration debates. For the better part of 100 years, Asian immigrants were stereotyped as the despised minority in America, with laws that excluded them from citizenship, efforts made to deport Asian U.S.-born citizens, and the first border efforts to exclude illegally entered Asians. Yet today, Asian Americans are hailed as the, quote, model minority, unquote, a stereotype to be sure, but at least a positive one. Erica Lee is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota and director of the Immigration History Research Center and one of the preeminent scholars on U.S. immigration. Her book, The Making of Asian America, tells the story of millions of Asian immigrants that crossed the Pacific, those who came to America in the 19th century to find Gold Mountain, but also Filipino sailors who settled in South Louisiana in the 18th century, indentured South Asians who worked alongside African slaves in the Caribbean as early as the 1500s, and Vietnamese and Hmong refugees who resettled here after the Vietnam War. She tells the story of these immigrants, as well as the backlash against immigration that has occurred time after time in our country. Erica Lee is my guest today to talk about her book, The Making of Asian America. Professor Lee, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Give us a sense of what led you to write this book. It's a very fascinating history of Asian migration and immigration to the Americas. You tell not only the story of here in the United States, although mostly in the United States, but also throughout the Americas, which I did not know. What led you to write the book?
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating history, and I think that for so many of us, as Americans, we're trying to figure out where do we fit into this changing landscape of American history. So we know that immigration is in the news almost every day today, and we can see outside in our neighborhoods and our schools that immigration really is transforming the United States. So this is what I study. I'm an immigration historian. My grandparents on both sides were immigrants. And I think that for me, much of what has drawn me to this topic is a search for where are the stories, where are the histories of people like my grandparents in American history. And so part of it started with a little bit of family history, but a lot of it started with just teaching American history day in and day out and continually noticing kind of the gaps in that larger history. And it's not just recent history. It's also, as you mentioned earlier, it goes way back. It goes back almost to before the United States history, before the United States was even a country, and certainly even before the British colonies. So it's a really fascinating history that extends centuries past and also extends to what's happening today.
And I think the point you make is there are these huge gaps in which there is sort of a lost history. There's certain events that most people know about, the Japanese-American relocation in World War II, the Exclusionary Acts in the late 1800s. But there's a lot that Americans don't know about this Asian immigration history. For example, we think of Asian migration beginning in the middle of the 19th century with the opening of California. But they've been in the New World since the 1500s.
Yeah, yes, definitely. So one of the things, you know, as any student of American history remembers, is we often start with the British colonies along the eastern seaboard. But, of course, so much of the United States had previously been Mexico, and then before that, Spain, part of Spain's Pacific Empire. And, of course, as being closer to the Pacific Ocean than the Atlantic, Asia and Asians started coming across the Pacific along with those Spanish ships. So some of the first, you know, we think about globalization today, and it's about airplanes and the globalization of culture and how you can get a McDonald's hamburger in Korea and anywhere else in the world. But historians think back to the early age of globalization, and they point to this really important time in the 1500s when Europe, Asia, the Americas, and Africa were all connected either through slavery, through trade, and especially across the Pacific Ocean with these massive ships called Manila Galleons. They started going across the Pacific Ocean in 1565 through 1815. They brought people, slaves, servants, indentured servants, sailors, and all sorts of luxury goods and everyday goods from Asia to the Americas.
And it's interesting, you mentioned indentured servants. Most of the workers that came, I mean, it was very much akin to slavery, but they were, there was sort of the fig leaf of indentured servitude.
Absolutely. So the history that really connects very closely to what we consider the beginning points of Asian American history, the mid-19th century, really begins then with indentured servants from South Asia and China going to places like Cuba and Peru to work on plantations. So this is right after the time that slavery and the slave trade has been abolished in the Atlantic world. Plantations in Cuba, for example, are and the West Indies are looking for labor to replace the African slaves who are no longer freely coming over across the Atlantic Ocean, and they start their search for Asia. And so hundreds of thousands of South Asians and Chinese go to Latin America to work on those plantations in a system that's very similar to slavery, but legally free. So it's a really interesting dynamic and kind of in-between space that these migrants are occupying.
How did it actually work? Was it a period of years, but once they finished their term, they were in debt or something? How did it exactly work?
It really differed from place to place. The most notorious site of indentured, and what your listeners might be familiar with, the term coolie, and this is the popular term that was used, but how it worked on Cuba, for example, so 250,000 Chinese were brought to Cuba on previously used African slave ships. They were bought by American and European and other ships that had simply, you know, just ended the African slave trade and then sort of rerouted to Asia to start bringing Asian laborers to Cuba. And we typically describe the system as slavery all but in name. So legally, they were free men, and they were mostly men. But the ways in which the system worked really worked to their disadvantage. So they signed a contract maybe for 10 years, but those years could be added onto by sick days or if you became in debt. And of course, all of your all of the food and clothing and things that you bought, you had to buy from the plantation owner, and the prices were jacked up really high, and so it was very easy to get into debt. So the periods legally had a set time, but they could be very much extended. And then even if you survived indenture, the system, again, worked to your disadvantage, where the local officers might arrest you and then place you back into indentured servitude. So it was a really harsh system of living and period of unfreedom for these migrants.
When did Asian immigration begin in the United States? Was it the middle of the 19th century?
That's the period of when the largest numbers first begin coming. But we can trace migration back to the late 1800s when Europe and America starts to bring Chinese luxury goods to, say, Boston, for example, and some sailors from Asia are also accompanying those ships. So we know that there are Asians along the eastern seaboard as early as the 1780s or so. And there's a community of Filipino ex-sailors who found a community down in Louisiana in the 1840s or so. But by the 1850s and the California Gold Rush, this is when the world rushes into California, not just Chinese, but also from France, Canada, Mexico, Yankees, of course, coming across the country. And we know that the Chinese migration, Chinese immigrants, are in the tens of thousands by the late 19th century by that time.
Yeah, you tell an interesting story in the book about a Fong Moy who was, I guess, the first recorded Chinese woman in the United States in the 1830s. She was actually put on display in New York. What was the reason for this?
So Americans have always had a really interesting relationship with Asia and Asian peoples and Asian goods. And in the 19th century, alongside with Europeans, Asia for America was really considered a place of fascination, exotic goods, a civilization that perhaps once was great but was perhaps now on the decline, but just very different from America. And so Ah Sang Moy is a 19-year-old Chinese woman who is taken on board a trading ship that is organized by two New York merchants, and they fill their ship with luxury goods like Chinese fans and furniture and tapestries, and they think that they could probably make some money off of exhibiting this young woman. So they dressed her up in richly brocaded gowns. They rent an exhibit space in New York City, and they advertise in the New York papers to come and see this exotic lady from the Far East. They ask her to put on a display of speaking a few words of Chinese, using chopsticks, walking around on her bound feet, and she's a hit. The cost for viewing her is 50 cents, and she eventually goes on tour around the United States. So it's really quite a testimony about Americans' fascination with Asia, and not so much in a respectful way, but as a
curiosity.
Sideshow, yes. Absolutely.
A curiosity, and it's simultaneously fascinated by the culture, and there's also a sense of superiority to the culture,
yes,
as well.
Absolutely.
Well, throughout the middle part of the 1800s, and certainly Chinese immigration, and then eventually Japanese immigration comes to the United States, there is this backlash, and it's in every way compares and maybe exceeds our current debates over immigration. You have the Exclusionary Act. In fact, there was just a story today on NPR about how during the Great Depression, about close to a million legal American citizens of Mexican ancestry were repatriated or sent out of the country during the Great Depression. You had the same thing happening in the United States with Asians in the late 1800s.
Right. This is one of those parts of this history that I think is, again, one of those gaps and something that is always comes as a surprise to most people, because I think the stereotype about Asian immigrants today is they're Google executives, they're the model minority, they ace their SATs. They're supposedly, quote-unquote, the good immigrants as opposed to the, quote-unquote, bad immigrants with all the attention on undocumented immigration. But a century ago, the great debate over immigration had nothing to do with Mexicans. Mexicans were coming freely across the U.S. border and recruited, but it had everything to do with Asian immigrants. And so that idea about Ah Sang Moy being an exotic curiosity and somewhat, Americans thinking that they were superior than Chinese, that idea really grows by the late 19th century. It combines with Americans' anxiety over a faltering economy. So you get some very now common arguments. Immigrants are taking away jobs. They're not assimilating. There are too many of them. They're crowding us out. And the focus really is on Asian immigrants, the first ones being Chinese, with a strong concern over their racial difference. And this sets in motion all sorts of new laws. Racial violence that was really unprecedented. Asian immigrants being driven out of small towns and big cities alike. The largest mass lynching in U.S. history took place in 1871 in L.A., targeting Chinese immigrants. This is, one of those untold stories that sheds light not only on what we're thinking about today with Asian immigrants, but also sheds light on our conflicted relationship with immigration over time.
My guest today is Erica Lee, a professor of history and historian at the University of Minnesota, director of the Immigration History Research Center there. And her book is titled The Making of Asian America, A History. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in the wake of those exclusionary laws, you saw two very different scenes, Ellis Island as it compared to Angel Island in the West, where Ellis Island was only denying people for life-threatening illnesses and very obscure reasons. Everything on Angel Island was about keeping Asians out.
Absolutely. I have grandparents who came through both Ellis Island and Angel Island, and their experiences are quite different. So Angel Island, it's now a National Historic Landmark, and It's called the, or when it was built in 1910, it was called the Ellis Island of the West. And again, I think this is one of those sites and stories in American history that is not often told. This is the place where immigrants from Asia are first brought, but because our immigration laws at that time are so discriminatory towards Asian immigrants, the experiences on Angel Island for them is quite different. So they are brought on ships that have a deck for Europeans and then a lower deck for Asian immigrants. They are brought into the immigration station through separate doors, Europeans only versus Asians only. They're placed in different detention barracks, Europeans versus Asians. They're given different food. I mean, this is Jim Crow, but in the far west.
Right. And once the Exclusionary Acts are in, it's like, I think the only people who could come in was people who had relatives who were working here, and they were looking for every reason to exclude Asian immigrants and send them back, right?
Right. So there are the vast majority of Asians who would have wanted to come were excluded by law. All laborers were excluded. But for the Chinese, there are small entry doors open for students and merchants, U.S. citizens, so birthright citizens, teachers, students, merchants, diplomats, and travelers. And so these small entry points become places where Chinese immigrants could continue to come, but it also becomes the place where Chinese immigrants, far from coming to the United States, try to come in using false identities, fraudulent papers. Some even try to avoid the immigration service altogether and cross the U.S.-Mexico border or cross the U.S.-Canadian border and essentially become America's first undocumented immigrant.
And in fact, our first U.S. efforts to actually control immigration and the border, if you will, quote, unquote, was Asians.
Absolutely. The first Border Patrol. They're former Texas Rangers who are employed by the U.S. Border Patrol. They're nicknamed Chinese catchers. I mean, that term really, you know, gives you an idea of what they're really focusing on. And they're trying to patrol the vast expanse of the U.S.-Mexico border and the U.S.-Canadian border. And, of course, this is before there is any border fence at all to speak of.
And they built detention centers, and you have stories of detainees kept there up to 2 years.
Absolutely. So we know that today there's a lot of controversy over the immigrant detention centers. We are detaining record numbers of immigrants today and in recent years. This history really does date back to places like Angel Island, which was a detention center for Chinese immigrants. About 100,000 came through Angel Island. Chinese made up 70% of the detainees, and they were subjected to invasive medical examinations, intensive interrogations that could last for days. They were cross-examined. They had to bring in witnesses to verify their claims. And all during that time, they were kept in detention in one big room, a huge barracks that was often overcrowded, and where they waited out their time, and sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months. The longest detention was over 2 years.
One of the interesting things about your book, The Making of Asian America, is all these sort of parallels. You're talking about detention centers now. And currently the debate is over the meaning of the 14th Amendment and whether citizenship is by soil or by blood. And this was a Supreme Court case involving Wong Kim Ark in the 1890s, where he was born in the United States, but his family was being deported. And this is part of this deportation of Asian nationals as well as of some American citizens who were born here. And this court case goes all the way to the Supreme Court, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So one of the recent proposals by Donald Trump is to end automatic birthright citizenship, which the 14th Amendment says any citizen born within the United States is a citizen thereof. And it was initially passed and introduced to give citizenship to freed African Americans, But the question arose in terms of U.S. citizens or persons born in the United States of immigrant parents who by law could not become naturalized citizens. So part of the anti-Chinese movement was not only to try to keep out Chinese immigrants, but also to enforce our naturalization laws that said only free white persons could become naturalized citizens. So Chinese were not white. They were prohibited from becoming naturalized citizens until 1943. So what does that mean for a Chinese-American person born in the United States of immigrant parents who cannot become naturalized citizens? So Wang Kimark is this test case. He's 19 years old in the 1890s. His parents are actually not being deported. They are going to China on a trip, and he accompanies them. And when he returns to the United States, the land of his birth, immigration officials want to make a test case, and they deny him entry into the United States, saying that the 14th Amendment does not apply to him because he is Chinese and because his parents are citizens of China and ineligible for citizenship in the United States. He goes ahead and he hires some of the best lawyers in San Francisco and takes this case to federal district court, where the federal district court rules in his favor and upheld the constitutionality of the 14th Amendment in relationship to people like him. The U.S. government challenges that ruling, and the case goes to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, again, rules in Wong Kim Ark's favor, establishing the right of birthright citizenship for all persons born in the United States, regardless of the immigration status of their parents. So the proposals today are to reconsider that case, but the precedence has stood for over 100 years, 120-something years, and it will be really interesting to see how the most recent proposals try to get around that legal precedence that has really been the core of how we understand birthright citizenship.
Now, we've been focusing a little bit on the Chinese, but this story sort of repeats itself, whether you're talking about Japanese, Filipinos, Southeast Asians, or South Asians, in their own migration stories, which you tell in the book. But at some point, and it's really, it's very interesting, it seems about to, at one of our most disgraceful episodes, the internment of Japanese-American citizens during World War II, all of a sudden, the American sort of view of Asians change, with exception of Japanese-Americans, and that changes right after the war. All of a sudden, these are not a despised minority. What happens?
So I think one of the reasons why I love writing about this topic and sharing it with folks is because these twists and turns in the American story are so fascinating. They really speak to the complicated nature of who we think is, who's in, who's out, what does that mean? How does it relate to what's going on inside our country and also what's going on in terms of our U.S. international relations? So World War II is this amazing turning point and fascinating window into exactly those twists and turns. It is, on the one hand, represents a peak in our anti-Asian sentiment. We forcibly remove, relocate, and incarcerate 120,000 Japanese Americans, two-thirds of whom are U.S. citizens, for the duration of the war. The travesty of this U.S. action is immense. I mean, they are forced to sell their property at great loss. They have to give away or destroy things. They lose their family homes, their businesses. Students are forced to leave, college, university, high school, et cetera, and they really never recover. But at the same time, there's a turning point for some other Asian American groups, including Chinese, Indians, and Filipinos, and it has everything to do with who is the U.S. Allied with and who are we fighting against. And with China, India, and the Philippines all now strong U.S. allies, the U.S. government realizes that it's they face an awkward international relations dilemma. How can we be strong allies with these countries and really, you know, go out and explain how grateful we are of our strong alliance when we have in place these really discriminatory immigration laws that are barely letting any of the subjects of our strong allied nations into the United States? And slowly, the laws change to allow very small, more numbers, but still very small numbers of those countries to come into the United States during World War II and afterwards.
But eventually, in 1965, the United States Immigration Act really changes that as far as the number of immigrants coming in.
Right, and this is such a great time to be talking about this law because next month marks the 50th anniversary of the passage of this law, a law that was signed into being by President Johnson on Liberty Island, so with the Statue of Liberty in the background and Ellis Island in the background. And it's the last time that we passed comprehensive immigration reform. And because of that law, our country has really been remade into a new kind of nation of immigrants. And some of the groups that have benefited the most were from Asia. And it's, again, another twist in this long history because of their history of being a despised minority and now being able to come into the country with much greater freedom.
Now, what can we learn from this history that we can apply to our... we've talked about a couple of things, but what is the one thing we haven't talked about that we can learn from this history that we can apply to our current debates over immigration?
One is that it's a highly complicated issue. I think that today when we talk about immigration or when we say the word immigrant, we have one image in our head, and that is of the quote-unquote illegal, dangerous, undocumented immigrant from Mexico or Latin America. And I think if anything, this history does shed light on how the stereotypes mask a much different reality and that we need to pay more attention to the perhaps disproportionate attention paid to the negative aspects of immigration and really dig through to better understand what are some of the realities and not just the hype, but also better understand the real lived experiences of people and why they come and what are their experiences and how are they struggling to become American and how are they contributing to our society and economy. So that's one question that I think is really important that sheds light on how we're trying to figure out where we are today and where do we want to be in the next 50 years.
Well, Professor Lee, Erica Lee, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Erica Lee is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota and director of their Immigration History Research Center and the author of The Making of Asian America, A History. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent episodes or you want to listen to an old episode on demand, it's very easy. We have a new web address that takes you right to Studio Tulsa where you can listen to our archives, studiotulsa.org. Check it out. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.